Welcome to episode 38 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Michelle Brechtelsbauer, Director of Stakeholder Relations at the Energy Impact Center in Washington, D.C. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. The Energy Impact Center is a Washington, D.C.-based research institute that explores climate risk, environmental data, and energy technology. Their mission is to put better information into the public sphere regarding the risk and potential paths forward associated with carbon emissions. They aim to educate on technical concepts using both scientific data coupled with a rigorous analysis. The Energy Impact Center also produces the podcast Titans of Nuclear, featuring interviews with experts on nuclear energy, talking to host Brett Kuglemas. They've compiled an incredible audio encyclopedia of the greatest minds in nuclear energy, opening the field to environmental-minded technologists. Over the next couple of weeks, please don't miss some exciting guests on The Climate Champions, including Catherine Hamilton, co-founder and chair at 38 North Solutions and co-host of the Energy Gang podcast, and Vint Cerf, vice president and chief internet evangelist at Google and also recognized as one of the fathers of the internet. Prior to joining the Energy Impact Center, Michelle worked as an analyst at the Science and Technology Policy Institute, STPI, and served under the Obama administration's Office of Science and Technology Policy. Michelle holds a master's degree in public policy from the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Alabama. She is dedicated to empowering energy and climate leaders to advance transformational solutions in the fight against climate change. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm here in Washington, D.C., talking to Michelle Brechtelsbauer, Director of Stakeholder Relations at Energy Impact Center. Welcome to Climate Champions, Michelle.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Can you talk about your motivating moment when it comes to climate change?
Sure. So when I was younger, about 11 years old, my family took a trip for the first time overseas. We went to Sweden for a family reunion, and Sweden's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful country. And I just fell in love with the culture and the atmosphere and the nature. And we took one day trip where we went over to Denmark. And I remember being just kind of shocked. And I'm sure this was just a child kind of understanding things a little differently at the time, by the contrast in how the Swedish side of the channel was just so pristine. And in Denmark, in Copenhagen, it was just filled with smog and there were smokers. And this contrast was the first time I really thought about.
I don't think the folks in Denmark are going to like this podcast.
I don't know they will, but it was for me as an 11-year-old child, just noticing, you know, what I was seeing on the ground. It was the first time to really make me think about environmentalism and how different cultures can approach the environment in different ways. So I'd say kind of my start in caring about climate really started by caring about the environment. And then I was really formally introduced to climate change for the first time in undergrad. I went to the University of Alabama and studied chemical engineering, and I minored in interdisciplinary environmental studies. I worked in a research lab where I was working on developing solvent solutions for carbon capture and storage. I was also very active in a student group that was focused on environmental justice, and it was actually through that work that really kind of got me interested in political action and politics as a way to make political change, to make change in terms of climate and environmental issues. Those were all kind of motivating moments for me, but I think my pivotal moment was when it came time to really start my career. After undergrad, I went to graduate school. I was studying a PhD in chemical engineering, and I just really felt like this insane sense of urgency around climate change that I'd never really understood before. And it was really that sense of urgency, as well as, you know, other reasons about a PhD that can be incredibly stressful, that made me realize that I wanted to make more meaningful contributions earlier in my career.
Do you remember what set off that feeling, that urgent feeling?
I think it was kind of just looking ahead at, I'm going to study one very small niche topic for 5 years, that what I find at the end of this dissertation might make a difference, but it might not. And I was also taking classes at Harvard Kennedy School. I was at MIT, so I was able to kind of go over across the city and take a class at HKS and learn more about policy. And I was like, this is where I want to be. I really caught the policy bug, I'd say. So it was actually that helped me make this decision to leave my program in chemical engineering and transition to a degree in public policy, where I wanted to focus on energy policy. Yeah, and so kind of in between that transition across disciplines, I was really fortunate to have some advisors that suggested I look into DC, which is where energy policy isn't really set, but is where we work on policy in the US. And I was fortunate to be selected for an internship with the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is under the Obama White House under Dr. John Holdren.
Any regrets about making the switch?
Not at all. Like, absolutely not. It was very stressful to kind of, when you're in academia, everyone wants you to stay in academia because they're in academia and it's kind of the way that they know. And also in science policy, the traditional track is to get a PhD in some kind of niche area and then suddenly go off and make policy. But I didn't see that as the smartest way. It just didn't make sense to me. I said, well, shouldn't I am already a chemical engineer. I understand the science. I want to be taught policy making and decision making as well. So I think it's smarter for me to get real world experiences in DC and formal education in policy so that I can really make a difference. So yeah, when I was at OSTP, I was in way over my head. I did not know what I was doing, but I was given some amazing opportunities to work on really important topics and with really amazing people. I was working on the Chinese economic and strategic dialogues, working on some negotiations for that. Got to run some climate change seminars for kids and teachers who came to DC for a workshop and various other things. I was working in the energy and environment division, so anything that had to do with energy, environment, including climate, I had a little small hand in, and it was a wonderful experience to get me started.
Do you have any personal drivers that keep you motivated?
I've always been really fascinated by energy and by policy, like I mentioned, and climate really sits in the middle of those. Why I think I really care so much about energy and why that makes climate change so much more important is I really believe that energy access is just as much of a human right as access to clean water and to clean air. Having access to cheap electricity enables everything that we do in society. It gives us our medicine, our food, it connects us to one another. It allows people to start businesses, to come out of poverty. And having the infrastructure and the policies and the procedures and all of the things that go into a society where you're able to deliver cheap, clean, affordable electricity to your citizens, that motivates me. And of course, at the same time, energy historically has been the driver of climate change. And so it's really looking at that dichotomy that has made me so interested in continuing to focus on large-scale energy systems that can deliver lots of energy to masses of people, but also to really make a difference in climate.
When you meet people that don't believe in climate change, mm-hmm. or a twist I'm hearing more of recently is that humans aren't the cause of climate change, mm-hmm. how do you explain to them that they're incorrect?
This is something I don't actually encounter much. What I think is really fortunate today is, at least for my generation and you know, probably the bubble that I do live in, and I've been mostly in kind of an academic circles and much of my career and in policy circles. But I think most people today, they recognize climate change is happening. Whether or not it's caused by humans, they recognize that it is a threat to them either directly or indirectly. And they, most of them, do recognize that it's something that we need to take urgent action on because it is caused by our emissions that we are emitting today and the emissions that we emitted decades ago. It's something that I don't have to combat often, even though I do come from rural, you know, a rural area where people kind of stereotype and assume that people don't believe in climate change, but that just hasn't been my experience. But what I will say is that what I more often have to explain to people is what people mean when we talk about deep decarbonization, which is one of the missions of my organization, the Energy Impact Center. The goal of deep decarbonization pathways is to limit the amount of temperature rise to no more than 2 degrees centigrade, which is kind of the scientifically and politically agreed upon target that's been set. And we have to also recognize that, even that target would still result in catastrophic changes to the planet. Deep decarbonization focuses on limiting temperature rise. That's kind of the key. Now, the solutions that are talked about when we talk about this focus on ways to reduce emissions. But what often gets lost in the public discourse is that it's actually the carbon that's already in the air that determines the rate of heat capture, not the magnitude of temperature. What that implies is that even if we were to eliminate all new emissions by our target deadlines, that would not stop temperature rise. So to kind of rephrase it, as long as the rate of heat capture, which is caused by the amount of emissions that are currently in the atmosphere, as long as that remains positive, we haven't started to address the problem of climate change at all. And so this is what we focus on communicating at the Energy Impact Center, because it's not something that most people talk about. And it's actually led to this synonymous discourse equating reducing energy emissions and solving climate change. And that can lead to a set of more unproductive solutions. That's something we try to make sure that people really understand.
But reducing emissions helps with climate change.
Yes, reducing emissions.
It's just not sufficient.
Exactly. Yeah. The real challenge towards halting temperature rise is removing existing carbon as well as halting future carbon emissions. So only once we really start to talk about removing the carbon dioxide that's in the air and no more carbon being added, then we're talking about preventing or even reversing climate change.
I did talk to somebody named Howard Newman, one of my previous episodes, and he worked with Salk Institute. He funded their efforts initially to increase the amount of CO2 plants and trees could keep in the ground.
Yes.
As opposed to giving
through
it back.
Through bioengineering.
So it's really exciting what they're looking at.
Yeah, there's lots of really, really cool solutions around carbon sequestration, whether they be biological or technological from direct air capture, carbon sequestration and storage, or even direct air capture systems that are plugged into our kind of current industrial processes where we're able to make carbon neutral fuels or carbon negative products, like just putting carbon in the air into plastic.
A professor I know at UCSD is using carbon to make surfboards.
Perfect example. Perfect example. In fact, I believe there is a XPRIZE right now that is kind of focusing on that back end. Right now, we have the technology to capture carbon, but it hasn't really taken hold. But as we're working on developing that out and developing the power systems to power those systems, we also have to think about these products of the future that will be able to sequester carbon for a long time. So having people who are looking at how to do the process on the back end is really important as well.
Tell me about what Energy Impact Center does and what do you do?
The Energy Impact Center is a DC-based research institute that focuses on climate change and deep decarbonization. We kind of approached climate change a little different than most think tanks, I'd say. We kind of started to look at the solution set backwards and really kind of take a first principles approach to understanding what needs to be done in this space. So when you do the math and you kind of look at what we need to achieve and the amount of time that we have to achieve it, it starts to become extremely clear that we do actually have the tools in our toolbox to address climate change, and that nuclear energy is the most powerful tool that we have. So like I mentioned, kind of our goal needs to be net negative emissions, and that needs to be globally across all sectors, not just electricity. And we also, according to, you know, IPCC, need to do this by 2040. That essentially means that we need to achieve that extreme energy abundance with an extremely low carbon footprint. And that's where nuclear comes in for us. I'm sure there are reservations about nuclear power. Everyone has them. I had them myself.
I'm going to ask you about those.
Like I mentioned, I kind of cut my teeth in D.C. under the Obama administration, and I grew up in this hearing, you know, this all of the above energy strategy. And I definitely think that there is a role to play from many different energy sources. Geothermal in particular, I think, is really important as well, and hydroelectric and some renewables. So nuclear, it currently supplies about 20% of the United States electricity. And it's about 55% of the clean energy capacity that we have. And that's coming from just 100, or less than actually, 100 nuclear plants. That demonstrates amazing energy density that nuclear has. And when you think about the problem, as I laid it out earlier, and how much energy we need to not just power our current electricity needs in the United States, but also globally, and then also to power direct air capture systems and other technology solutions and innovations that will be coming forward in the future to really address climate change, we're going to need a lot of energy and we're going to need it soon. And nuclear is by far the most efficient and cost-effective tool that we have to decarbonize. So that's why we focus on nuclear energy. And at the Energy Impact Center, we kind of started with this understood how important nuclear energy was. And our founder, Brett Kugelmass, kind of started out by just trying to understand what's going on with nuclear. If it really is such a potentially powerful tool in addressing climate change, why is it hindered right now? I mean, what are the challenges that we have with it? And so he started a podcast called The Titans of Nuclear that interviews experts in the nuclear industry and proliferally and kind of just tries to tell that story.
It sounds familiar to me, by the way.
Yeah. So he's about almost at 200 episodes in a little under 2 years. We're really kind of putting out, I would say, the most educational resource out there about nuclear power and trying to spin it in a positive light and get people excited about the potential of nuclear energy to address climate. At the Energy Impact Center, aside from the Titans podcast, where I work more in, our work tries to do is understand the drivers of cost in nuclear energy and also incubate entrepreneurial ecosystems that can encourage the deployment of nuclear power projects in the future. The challenge is, how do we build it cheap and how do we build it fast? And to do that, we're going to need a whole bunch of stakeholders to really focus on this one thing. So my role, I'm the director of stakeholder relations, and my role is to really lay this groundwork. I work with industry and labs and utilities and government and think tanks, and I try to develop partnerships in the United States and abroad to develop kind of a common understanding of what this challenge really is, and also work with the nuclear industry and encourage them, who are the key holders to this technology, to be more bold and to be more progressive so that we can deploy new nuclear and start to really tackle climate change. I really focus on thinking around our strategic goals and think of ways to answer some of the fundamental questions that we've kind of come up with that need to be addressed for nuclear. You know, how can you change an old industry with an ingrained culture? How do you deal with an environmental community that doesn't really like nuclear and is scared of nuclear? And how do you talk to a public that doesn't understand nuclear? And then fundamentally, how do you change kind of the fundamental economic principles of the entire industry?
Nuclear energy has some issues associated with it. So I'm going to give you some of those issues.
Sure.
I would just like to hear your thoughts about them. And one is cost, both capital and maintaining, the potential health danger, potential weaponization, the fact that it's slow to do a project and to actually get it built.
Yes.
I've also been hearing a lot about modular nuclear generation, but I haven't heard about it for a while or how it's going.
We can start with cost. Nuclear is 10 times more expensive than it needs to be. The reason it's expensive for many reasons, but the main reason has to do with safety. We've done a lot of work at the Energy Impact Center to kind of understand some of the major cost drivers, and I could share some of those with you. A lot of it has to do with construction management. At some of the sites where we're currently building nuclear reactors in the United States, there are up to 8,000 workers on one site. What we really should be thinking about as an industry is, how can we spread those 8,000 workers across 8 projects with 1,000 workers each, so that we're building more nuclear, not just creating a ton of jobs at one site. And I think that is something that we really need to challenge the industry to think more about. I mean, we can build a high-rise building. You see cranes all around DC in just a couple of years. But a nuclear power plant is not much more difficult to build and to construct than any other thermal generation plant. What is more complicated are the regulations and the safety systems. And so we definitely have some work to do there. But even still, those aren't so much more complicated. We do have a lot of legacy regulations within the nuclear industry. For example, back when nuclear reactor vessels were first being designed in the 40s and 50s, there were certain types of standards put in place for how those had to be built that were based on the technologies and metals and alloys are available of the day. And those haven't been updated. Similar with radiation standards. When we first started regulating radiation, limits were set for radiation that are actually 10,000 times higher than they need to be. The known dose of radiation to hurt a human is 100 millisieverts. But we regulate our nuclear plants to be safe enough at 0.01 millisieverts. That's 10,000 times difference. We have regulations and standards
that can't even say millisieverts.
that are not reflective of our current understanding of how radiation impacts biology. And those are just a few things. There's many ways to tackle cost. You also mentioned
weaponization.
When you think about what it would take to build a dirty bomb from nuclear waste and how difficult it would be to get that waste out of a nuclear facility. What I often think about is just how easy it would be to get nuclear waste and radioactive material from a hospital. One of the things that the public often thinks about when they're thinking about nuclear energy is it's this scary thing, but they don't often think about the risks that they choose to ignore every day in other areas or other types of emissions that are being emitted that actually are causing climate change, asthma, cancer. I think nuclear energy unfairly gets kind of this scary picture painted on it because of the dramatic stories that people try to tell about it. And many of these stories have been perpetrated by anti-nuclear environmental groups. But some of the blame can also be put on the nuclear industry itself. I don't think that the nuclear industry, while they are absolutely brilliant people, engineers, scientists, physicists, chemists, not all of them are PR experts. And I think responding to disasters and accidents by saying we're going to make it safer is not always the best message to say, to have, when in reality, it was actually already really safe. You look at Fukushima as an example, where there were three core meltdowns, and you can include Three Mile Island. Those are the four commercial core meltdowns that have ever happened in the history of nuclear reactors operating. No one has ever been hurt from radiation exposure from any of those accidents. The people that unfortunately were hurt during Fukushima, aside from the tsunami hitting the disaster that happened there, were actually the result of the evacuation that ensued. People, elderly people being unplugged from life support and life support systems.
So you mean nobody was killed from the radiation?
No one was killed from the radiation. No one was even hurt from the radiation. We know how to deal with radiation leaks. If you just don't go in the room and you wear the proper protection, you use the proper robotics technologies, then you aren't going to be exposed by it. You don't have to evacuate an entire city, which is what causes the panic and which is what causes the fear. So I think our responses to some of these accidents have not been the best for the industry itself.
I didn't know that. I thought people had died from radiation due to these leaks. I didn't know that the toll is zero.
Yeah.
On radiation.
None.
There's a lot of things in society we accept, like automobiles. So many people die every year because of driving, but we wouldn't give that up.
I think, yeah, I mean, if you were to Google like how many people died in Fukushima, it depends on how you read them. Like, what did they die from is very important. The evacuation caused a lot more trauma in Japan than did the radiation itself.
How is the progress on SMRs?
A lot of really exciting work being done on small modular reactors. When you think of a nuclear reactor, you're probably thinking of the large gigawatt scale plant that's powering an entire city, let's say. A small modular reactor is going to be about a third of the size of that or less. So the max is about 300 megawatts. There are lots of companies developing small modular reactor technologies right now. The one that is the furthest along in terms of the certification process with the NRC to get a license to build is NuScale. They're the furthest along and they're looking for places to build. SMRs are different from the typical light water reactors, boiling water reactors that the NRC is used to regulating. And so they kind of had to redo their parts of their licensing process. But after NuScale gets through, maybe in a couple more years, you'll have the first one licensed, and hopefully other designs will be able to become licensed and built. NuScale is currently in talks with many different possible buyers to sell their reactor to, and hopefully one will be built very soon. Applications for small modular reactors, you know, like I said, they're very small. So they could power, let's say, a rural city in Alaska that isn't hooked up to the grid. Talk about distributed energy, but for a small town, they can power a industrial facility that requires a lot of energy. A small modular reactor could power a desalination plant or a direct air capture system and provide water or climate change solutions in places that other types of electricity might not be able to get to. So yeah, there's a lot of excitement around SMRs. There's also excitement around micro reactors. They're even smaller than SMRs. The Department of Defense actually is looking at building out some micro reactors and has some RFPs out for vendors for micro reactors right now. So yeah, a lot of innovation on the small modular reactor side, especially nations that aren't as large as the United States, are really excited about SMRs. When you think about African countries, for example, that don't have these massive cities they need to power, you don't need a gigawatt of energy. They might only need 200 megawatts or so. And so it's a new kind of opportunity for energy, clean energy, to be taken to some places that haven't had that access before.
So I'll tell you what I heard, and you tell me if I'm wrong or right. I heard a big advantage is that you can produce them in more of a factory setting and then ship them to where they need to go instead of building them right where they need to be in the end.
Yes, you can ship them on a truck or ship. Mm-hmm.
And I heard that the radioactive material they use could be spent radioactive material.
Some designs, yes, do use previously used spent nuclear fuel.
Do the SMRs look to be less expensive?
Well, in theory, yes. And this is what kind of is the leading talking point of a lot of these companies. If you're shrinking the size of the plant from 1,000 megawatts to 200 megawatts, you would expect everything else to also be shrunk in terms of cost and labor and all of those things. In theory, yes. We'll have to see in practice how that really works out. But until one is built, we won't actually know.
Can you talk about your prior background before coming to the center?
After my internship with OSTP that I mentioned earlier, I went to do an MPP, a Master's of Public Policy, at the University of Michigan, where I focused on science and technology policy and specifically drilled down on energy policy. While I was in that program, there was a requirement to do a internship in between your 2 years. And so I was looking at places to go, and I remembered this amazing organization that I was introduced to while I was at OSTP called the Science and Technology Policy Institute, which is a very unique organization. It's a FFRDC. It's a federally funded research and development center, which is a special type of organization, kind of a quasi-governmental organization that can kind of act on behalf of and for government agencies, but also speak to the private sector. So it can kind of occupy that space in the middle where government might not be able to talk to private sector and vice versa. And so I did my internship at STPI. And then after I graduated my MPP, I was asked to come back to STPI full time. And so I was there actually for the past 4 years before coming to the Energy Impact Center, working as a science policy analyst. And STPI really is the research arm of OSTP. So they were chartered by Congress to serve OSTP, to conduct all the research, kind of really be the legs of the organization, because you can only have so many civil servants doing things. You really need researchers conducting a lot of the really in-depth analysis and to provide objective options to decision makers and to policymakers. So they're chartered by Congress and they serve OSTP, but they also serve all of the federal science agencies. And they're the smallest FFRDC, only about 50 people. Yeah, so I worked for STPI 4 years working on a range of topics, from mostly in my first 2 years focused on energy environment, things like earth observations, desalination, water security, and then in later on kind of focusing more on kind of broader topics like technology transfer, R&D infrastructure issues, etc. So yeah, so I worked for STPI for quite a while and then eventually got asked to come over to the Energy Impact Center.
How did that happen?
That actually kind of happened out of the blue. I was at STPI. And I just got a random message from our director, Brett Kugelmoss, and said, hey, you know, I think I have a position that based on your profile on LinkedIn, you might be interested in. And after a few conversations with Brett, I was like, yeah, this organization seems really legit.
Very exciting.
So it was, I was really driven by the mission, and it was hard. It was a very hard choice to leave an organization that was so comfortable. A large corporation, or we were run by a large corporation, and to go to a tiny startup where I was actually the first full-time employee was terrifying. It was an opportunity to work on climate change directly and to work on energy directly. And that's something I've always wanted to get towards in my career. And I was really excited to jump on the opportunity.
Very cool. Can you talk about setbacks that you've had?
Oh, I'd say the hardest time I've had in my career was after the administration changed. I really had a first row seat to watch the erosion of scientific and evidence-based decision-making across institutions, policies and procedures, and even civil servants being discouraged from the work that they've been doing for their entire lives. And it was really disheartening to watch. While it worries me that a lot of institutional memory in those organizations has been lost over the past 2 years, especially in federal science agencies, I also am really encouraged that as those institutions are rebuilt, it'll be an opportunity to shift our priorities to the most pressing issues that are facing our nation right now, like climate change.
I like that you're trying to think about it in a positive way, because sometimes that's difficult for me, watching some of these laws be overturned and definitely going in the wrong direction when we seem to be going in the right direction. But the idea that you just talked about, where when you rebuild, you can often rebuild a lot stronger, a lot more focused. Mm-hmm. You know what the problems were before and you maybe can avoid them. That could end up being a benefit.
Absolutely. I mean, government is a bureaucracy. And a lot of the things that we do in government are because we did them that way in the past. If there is any silver lining from what's been happening in these agencies over the past 3 years, hopefully it's that we will be even more efficient and more focused when we have the opportunity to focus on issues of national importance again.
Okay, I asked you about setbacks. What about successes that you're really proud of?
I'm still really young in my career, but what I think that has made me the most proud personally is just being able to go for opportunities and take risks, even despite being cautioned against them, when I feel like they are in line with my true motivations, passions, and what I think is important to do. Kind of like you doing this podcast and taking a risk to go out and do something that you find fulfilling. I feel like I've been able to do that a couple times in my career that have been really life-changing and altering, that went against the advice of my advisors. One of those was leaving my PhD program to go study policy and to go, you know, start working earlier. And then the other, I definitely would say, would be coming to the Energy Impact Center as a small startup and kind of leaving the comforts of a big corporate job.
I don't think you should compare yourself to me at all. I did not take enough risk, and I admire you for the risks you're taking. I think that's just great. And I'm glad it's working out. I hope it continues to work out and you continue to take risks and help save the planet.
Yeah.
I'm old. I waited until I was pretty secure before moving into a risky position.
Mm-hmm, Yeah, I mean, it's not that I'm moving into risky positions. I think it's that this urgency that I talked about feeling earlier. When I hear the number 2040, no, it's 2020.
I think of 2040 as a ridiculous number, actually, because
We're
looking at Greenland melting. Anchorage is 90 degrees. We have really bad weather events all the time. Mm-hmm. We don't have till 2040.
No, we don't. That's why we really need to be taking a hard look at what it's going to take to address climate change. And it might not be the most sexy path. I think what worries me today about our climate change discourse is that we get too wrapped up in our favorite solutions. But really, we need to take a step back and we need to think about what is the problem and how can we solve it and how can we start solving it today. We can't say we're going to innovate our way out of this. We're going to invent some amazing technology in the future. There is not enough time to wait for that. And so we need to start embracing the solutions that we have at our disposal so that we can have the opportunity to innovate in the future I just think it's so important for us to keep that timescale in mind. And for those who are privileged enough to act on that feeling of urgency to do something about it.
One issue that concerns me is that it seems that in every conversation, distributed energy, which I love, by the way, and climate change go hand in hand. Mm. But if you're really serious about making a difference with climate change soon, wouldn't you tap into the utilities as hard as you could? They already have money. They already have a methodology of how to invest money to bring power to market. Wouldn't you lean on that? I mean, I know it isn't popular from...
Oh, it's not.
I love the distributed energy, and I love the companies doing it. I love the batteries they're putting out there. But is that the quickest method? I don't think we know where that path even leads, whereas we know that utilities can just throw it down. That being said, I don't like the fact that they're monopolies, and that's how they make money, and they're... I'm on both sides of the equation, but at some point we need a map that's fast to get us to where we need to be.
Well, it goes beyond just utilities having this capability to move fast. I think it's also the infrastructure that we currently have in place for other forms of energy. Think oil companies and gas companies. All of this infrastructure to create hydrocarbons that we then put in our cars and emit more carbon dioxide with. What if we could take all of that, keep all of that existing infrastructure and use it to reverse climate change by causing that entire system to be net neutral? So this is actually something that I have found the most fascinating since starting at the Energy Impact Center. It's kind of the core, one of the core theses that our founder, Brett Kugelmass, likes to talk about. And that's kind of painting this vision of the future where you can use our current fossil dependent infrastructure and then reverse it. If we can take carbon dioxide from the air, as opposed to taking it from the ground and do it from the air cheaper, then we can utilize our existing infrastructure to make carbon negative products and carbon neutral fuels. The disruption that would cause to global economies, supply chains is so much more minimal and would honestly happen on such a quicker timescale. Now, how do we do that? We have to get big oil companies and utilities and the people that really do have all the power in the energy industry to understand that process and to invest in direct air capture and to invest in energy systems that can power that process, like nuclear energy. That's the end goal. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if we can ever get there.
I think in general, utilities are slow to change. But one thing that they're very fast to do is implement policies that are set by regulatory agencies and legislation. So if you legislate it, utilities are very good at doing it. If it makes them money, especially if you want to go fast, align all those things, align solving climate change with investment by utilities with the law. And I don't think that that's fair to innovative companies that are inventing new things. And I want them to have a piece of all this. But I think the most pressing need is to make a dent in climate change and to solve it as quickly as possible. And so whatever the path is that makes that happen, even if it's not as fair, I think we just need to do it at some point.
Yeah.
That point might have come.
For sure.
What is your vision of the future? Where do you think the world will be in 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, hopefully we'll have done some of these things we've been talking about. Hopefully we'll start to get really serious about tackling climate change. And that means we'll get really serious about thinking about the solutions that can get us there. Transitioning to a low carbon economy globally is an incredibly daunting task, but it's something that we have to do. And what I hope we start to realize is that that can only be done by realizing the full potential of nuclear energy.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I'd like to talk about really how the Energy Impact Center is starting to shift the dialogue around what it will take to lower the costs of nuclear energy and bring in new stakeholders. So one of the things that we are actually launching the end of this month is a series of prizes. We're calling the Nuclear Energy Grand Challenge, think the X Prize for Nuclear Energy, where we're aiming to generate interest from potential stakeholders that might otherwise not think much about nuclear, might not think that they have a stake in nuclear energy. Maybe they're more traditional construction companies, or they're steel companies that have never worked on nuclear, or utilities that have never had a nuclear plant, or people who really think about regulatory policy in a new and innovative way. We want to bring them into the conversation and incentivize them to come in and bring their innovations and their learnings so that we can start to tackle some of the most important issues that are hindering deployment of nuclear energy. I mentioned we're doing this in a series of stages. So the first stage is we're doing a pilot prize. And so we are partnering with the University of Michigan, my alma mater for grad school. We are doing a prize around nuclear waste, starting with the elephant in the room. The topic formally is reimagining nuclear waste. And what we're doing is we're challenging what will be teams of students that'll be interdisciplinary in nature. So not just nuclear engineering students, but business majors and marketing majors and policy majors and law majors to come up with business plan proposals to productize nuclear waste from commercial nuclear reactors. And in turn, come up with and create new markets and new uses for formerly underutilized or not used at all spent nuclear fuel.
Anything else?
I think I got everything I wanted to say.
Okay, then if it's okay, I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to try to do it with a wrap.
Sounds great.
Compared to Denmark, it was the Garden of Eden. You were motivated when you visited Sweden. At first, you were getting a PhD in Chem-E, but then you went to the OSTP. To stop the temperature rise of the world and the nation, we certainly need deep decarbonization. Regulations and safety drive the cost, but we've got to get it done cheaper or the environment will be lost. Roll Gold wants you to believe in Pretzel's power, but I prefer the energy from Michelle Pretzel's Bauer.
That's great.
Although the podcast might not be done by her, Energy Impact Center does Titans of Nuclear. For the best nuclear idea that is most wise, they're sponsoring a Nuclear Energy Grand Challenge Prize. They're having a contest to increase haste to see how to get rid of nuclear waste.
That's brilliant. That was so good.
It was slow.
That's okay. You get to edit it.
I was especially moved by Michelle's answer to her biggest setback, having a front row seat when the administration changed and witnessing the erosion of scientific and evidence-based decision-making across institutions, policies, procedures, and even civil servants being discouraged from continuing work they've been dedicated to for their entire careers. And while she's concerned, as I am, about the institutional memory that is being lost, she's encouraged with the potential silver lining of rebuilding with increased efficiency and extreme focus on the issues of national importance that the future may bring. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a workshop at an improv club near you. Michelle Brechtelsbauer leverages her background in engineering research and an expertise in science policy to accelerate deployment of carbon-negative energy technologies. She is dedicated to empowering energy and climate leaders to advance transformational solutions in the fight against climate change. She is focused on deep decarbonization and spearheading several research, advocacy, and engineering projects, as well as the Nuclear Energy Grand Challenge, all with a focus on drastically reducing the cost and increasing the deployment of nuclear energy, a significant technology to help mitigate climate change.